We can give you somebody who's the right background and education and interests, etc. But you can walk into a room and everybody's from your background and level of education and same religious and social values. We can give you people so that you can kiss fewer frogs. But you have to do the work. The only real algorithm is your own brain.
Welcome to U-Turns. This is the podcast where we talk about change in all areas of our life, including relationships. I am Lisa Oz.
And I'm Jill Herzig. You know, one of the things, Lisa, that we have in common, many things in common, number one, our vertically challenged status. We always talk about that. Is that we are both in long-term relationships. It's going to make it sound like we're 80 years old. We're not 80 years old, but I have been with my husband, Robert, for 33 years.
I thought you were you've been married for 25.
We've been married for almost 25. We've been together for 33 years, and we've known each other since we were 6 years old. So it's just been, it's like the bulk of my life. Robert has been part of my life. How long, and you and Mehmet are celebrating what?
We've been married for 33 years, together for 35.
Yeah.
We're like a gazillion in dog age. Very long relationships.
Very, very long relationships. But what one of the things we talk about, just girl talk, is that there are plenty of U-turns and kind of weird curveballs that you get thrown, even in a long-term relationship. Kind of doesn't matter. U-turns are, you know, love is a huge bending force in our life.
Mehmet always jokes that we've been married like four times because he's been married to four different women because I was like, yeah, you had one young woman and one really old one. couple middle-aged women. Anyway, we are joined today with someone who can help us navigate those ups and downs in our relationships. Helen Fisher, the biological anthropologist and author of 6 international bestsellers, is going to help us define what a successful relationship actually looks like. Welcome, Helen.
I'm delighted. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank
you. By the
way,
you know, I and my colleagues put people into brain scanners and study romantic love. And one of our studies was people who were in long-term happy marriages. And when I heard the two of you talking about that, and we discovered that you can remain in love with somebody long-term, not just loving, but in love with them long-term. You got to pick the right person, and you got to know how to argue, and you got to, you know, get through these different kinds of changes in partnership. I love that when you said that, Lisa, because I think that that's quite true. You can have very different relationships with somebody, and that's good. I mean, you're constantly innovating and growing and finding new ways to be together, and it's, you know, it can work.
Wings,
but you got to know
masks.
Something about the brain.
My husband gets bored very easily, so I have lots of disguises.
Good for you. Keep at it.
So what does make a successful relationship? It's not, success isn't just the 33, 50, 60-year marriage.
Yeah.
Success, you have a different definition of what makes a successful relationship. It doesn't have to be forever.
That's for sure. But over 50% of Americans do marry for life. So we're always hearing about all the ones that divorce, but we're not hearing about the ones that remain together and are actually in successful marriages. And in fact, I recently did a study of 1,100 married people, long-term married, all married more than 20 years. And I asked them a lot of questions. But one of the questions was, would you remarry the person you're currently married to? And 81% said yes. So it is possible.
Okay.
And
you feel certain that they weren't saying that just because, listen, it's the devil I know. I'm used to this person.
We did
not
it
cynical,
through the internet, and all the studies show that you are more honest on the internet because you're anonymous and there's no payoffs for winning or losing. So
and you
people
feel like
can
they,
lie, and people can lie to themselves.
So, not so much asking if they lied, but if part of it was, I'm comfortable with this person, I know them, I know their good and bad sides, and knowledge and predictability is better than going out there and maybe facing somebody somebody who's a complete mystery.
Well, I think that there's that. That's the psychological. But when we put them into the brain scanner, we saw activity in brain regions linked directly with romantic love, as well as brain regions linked with attachment. So you're talking about the long-term sort of attachment, which a great many married people express. But the bottom line is, in these people we put in the machine, they had maintained, they had told us in the lab that they were in love, not just loving, but in love with this person, which is distinctly different. And indeed, we found activity in brain regions linked directly with being in love. But anyway, you asked, Lisa, about, you know, what makes a long-term happy marriage. And you know, psychologists will say all kinds of things, and I agree with all of them. I mean, don't show contempt, don't threaten divorce, do new things together, et cetera, et cetera. But this is what the brain says. We put these people who are in long-term happy marriages into the brain scanner, and we found activity in three brain regions linked with happiness. One brain region was a brain region linked with the mirror neurons, linked with empathy, showing empathy towards the person. The second is brain regions linked with controlling your own stress and your own emotions. And the third is a brain region linked with positive illusions, the ability to overlook what you don't like about the person and focus on what you do. So what I'm trying to add is the neuroscience addition to what the psychologists tell you. And there are certainly our brain regions. You got to be empathetic, got to control your own emotions and your own stress, and you got to overlook what you don't like. Focus on what you do.
Fascinating. Because your reality really is determined by what you focus on. Right?
Exactly.
What you're seeing in this room, what you think is this room, is what you're focusing in not all the other things that are going on in the corners.
Absolutely. And I often wonder it's a great human trait to be able to get into other people's heads and see what they're thinking, you know, and responding appropriately to that.
It also kind of explains when you meet a married couple and you think, how can, say, that guy put up with that woman? She is the most annoying person I've ever met. This is nails on a chalkboard. I can't even stand to be with her through dinner. And he's beaming at her and puts his arm around her and helps her into the car. And you think, no, he loves her.
Yeah.
It's the what illusion? What did you call it?
Positive illusions.
Right, and positive illusions.
It's so interesting. It was Tolstoy's in the beginning of Anna Karenina. He said that all happy marriages do you remember this one? All happy marriages are the same and all bad marriages are different. I think it's the reverse. I think all happy marriages, you don't know, just like you just said with that couple where you couldn't stand the woman. But in fact, they have all kinds of intricate connections to each other that we don't know, don't see, and it's good for them. So, you know.
Well, part of it's the main thing we don't see is their sex life, right? So
exactly.
Sex could be a big part of it.
And I do think that, you know, I've long maintained that we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is the sex drive, second is feelings of intense romantic love, and the third is feelings of deep attachment. And I do think in long-term marriages, you should keep all three of those brain systems cooking. So continually do have sex with the person. It does, you know, good. Any stimulation of the genitals that's welcome drives up the dopamine system in the brain and can help sustain feelings of intense romantic love. And with orgasm, there's a real flood of oxytocin, and that's associated with feelings of deep attachment. So sex drive can help to stimulate those other two brain systems, romantic love and attachment. So if you want to get along with somebody, keep the sex alive.
Don't
do novel things together, because that drives up the dopamine system and can sustain feelings of romantic love. And stay in touch. Hold hands, walk arm in arm, learn to sleep, at least start sleeping in the person's arms at night. Any kind of touch can sustain feelings of the oxytocin system. So the more we know about the brain, we know all kinds of sort of natural mechanisms to find actually a person, the right person, and then sustain the relationship.
You know, we have had conversations kind of marveling at couples we know who admit that they're in sort of a sexless marriage. I mean, maybe they don't tell you this right away, but you kind of find out. And they've somehow made themselves okay with it.
I think
how does that work?
Yeah. I think there's different personality styles. You know, I study personality, the biology of personality. And we've evolved four very broad styles of thinking and behaving linked with the dopamine, serotonin, testosterone, and estrogen systems. And those people who are very expressive of the traits in the serotonin system tend to have less of a sex drive and sex is less important to them in the partnership. These people tend to be traditional, conventional, follow the rules, respect authority, concrete rather than theoretical thinkers, tend to be more religious and very dutiful. And sex is not a great priority for them. So, I mean, that's
we're
one of the...
We're not that type, Joe.
No, we're not that type. And you don't strike me as that type. Because if I was married to that type, like that
were
would...
you?
No, well, no. Yeah. Oh, if were. I had been, I mean, yeah. it seems like, so do types need to find similar types?
High dopamine people, risk-taking, novelty-seeking, curious, creative, spontaneous, energetic people tend to be drawn to people like themselves. High serotonin people, traditional, conventional, following the rules, etc., tend to be drawn to people like those themselves. So in those two cases, similarity attracts. But high testosterone people tend to be drawn to high estrogen and vice versa.
You mentioned evolution. And for millennia, for most of human history, we didn't get to pick on Match.com. So I'm just wondering, when you were talking about the different types, can you make a relationship where you're not compatible actually satisfying?
Yeah, I think you can. But by the way, I mean, we're never always completely compatible with anybody. I mean, we do a good 40 to 60% of our traits come from our biology, but another 40 to 60% come from our childhood. And, you know, you can be very high dopamine, but be scared of jumping off bridges. I don't want to jump off bridges, you know, and if my partner wants to jump off bridges, he can do it that way. Yes, these brain systems evolved, and I think that once you get to know who your partner is and how they're built and what they need, you can do all kinds of workarounds, even around the parts that are incompatible, definitely.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to do a deeper dive into love with Helen Fisher. We are having a conversation about love with Dr. Helen Fisher, and we've just been talking about evolution, and I was pointing out that for a lot of the population, arranged marriages are a reality and have been for millennia, but you have a different perspective on that. I want to get into that a little bit.
Great. Well, I'm an anthropologist, and of course, I spent a lot of time studying hunting and gathering societies because that's where all of our evolved talents and techniques and drives evolved. And in hunting and gathering societies, they did not have arranged marriages.
Interesting.
Nobody had any property, and that wouldn't have worked. We lived in little hunting and gathering groups, and women were just as economically and socially and sexually powerful as men. They went off every morning or a few mornings a week to gather their fruits and vegetables. They came home with 60 to 80% of the evening meal, a lot. Women could express their sexuality, and they could choose partners that they liked. We lived in egalitarian societies where the double income family was the rule, and women and men chose partners for love.
Did we pair bond, or did have more like a harem situation?
Oh, it was pair bonding. Very few harems in hunting and gathering societies, because how could a man provide for a whole pile of women? And what were all those extra men going to do except sneak in out of the bushes and, you know, sleep with
Make
the girls
trouble.
They liked, et cetera. So in hunting and gathering societies, the only way you can get several women to follow you is if you're very charismatic. But they don't own any property. They keep on moving. So you're not going to marry the man for his 50 fruit trees because he's going to be gone tomorrow, you know, with the fruit trees. So bottom line is we have probably been evolved pair bonding, forming a pair bond over 4.4 million years ago. And along with the evolution of forming pair bonds to rear our young, we evolved these very strong brain systems for romantic love and deep attachment to a long-term partner. Only 3% of mammals do pair up to rear their young. 97% do not. And we are one of those special species, if you want to call us special, who form pair bonds long term. And along with that came all kinds of beliefs about romance and attachment. Yeah, in hunting and gathering societies, they've got myths and legends and songs and dances. And, you know, people get terribly jealous and they divorce. A good
An amazing soap opera, like a nighttime soap.
Well, we're going back to that today. What really changed for humanity is when we settled down on the farm. And then suddenly women lost their ancient roles as gatherers. They were stuck on the farm. Men's roles became much more powerful and important. They had to move the trees, move the rocks, fell the trees, plow the land, and go off to local markets and come home with the equivalent of money. So you see a real skew towards patriarchy and in for the last 10,000 years. What's so wonderful about today is we're shedding that farming lifestyle. Women are moving back into the job market. You know, people will always ask me, is technology changing love? We can get into that. But the bottom line is the really powerful modern trend is not technology. It's women piling into the job market in cultures around the world. And with that, we're moving forward towards women's economic, social, sexual power. You can see that today in front of our eyes. The rise again of the double income family. You no longer have to stay in a very bad partnership. You can divorce and find somebody new who's more suitable to you. And the millennials have gotten it. I'm very impressed with millennials. I study them through Match.com. They're very ambitious. They don't want to catch feelings and get into a long-term partnership until they're positive they know who this person is. We're seeing the extension of what I call the pre-commitment stage of relationships. We're getting to know these people so that by the time we walk down the aisle, we know who we got, we know we want who we got, we think we can keep who we've got. And well, I think marriages may become more stable.
And I've definitely noted and been kind of buoyed by your sense that I think you call it slow love, this
yes,
kind of slow
yes.
extended courtship.
Oh, I'm so glad you know about that.
I do, and yeah. and it's a very sort of optimistic way of looking at courtship now.
Yeah,
but
it's based on facts, though. I mean,
yes,
you know, I am
and
an optimistic
what I'm
person,
say is
but it's
totally
based on
anecdotal.
Yeah,
but I've noticed that for some people, slow love really is no love. And I'm not just talking about, you know, kind of women at midlife where I'm at. You know, I have a dear friend and her two daughters are both incredibly smart, accomplished, super attractive, zero romantic lives. They are in middle to end of college now. No serious boyfriends. No sex so far as, anyway, their mom knows. And this mom knows a lot about their lives. It seems as though for some people, the kind of slow, let's test this out, let me kind of go out in groups, let me be casual, maybe friends with benefits before I commit to you. For some people, it's just slowing to a crawl and to nothing.
Well, you're talking about people who are still in college.
Mm-hmm.
And people still in college really want to get their career together. I mean, I've got data on 35,000 Americans through Match.com. We don't poll the Match members. We poll the American public. So it's a representative sample based on the U.S. Census. And college kids don't want to get hooked up long term. Mm-hmm. They really don't. And I would guess that if those girls went to their mother at age 18, 19, 20, whatever they are, and said, I want to get married next month, the mother would say, you're too young. We
Definitely,
are in a totally different period of time. In many respects, I regard that as very healthy, and they're probably having sex now and then and not telling their mother now. Since when do anybody tell their mother about their one-night stands?
Hormones are hormones.
I mean, but bottom line is this is what the young are doing, this long, long pre-commitment, slow love stage. Both of those girls will fall in love. It's a basic brain system. It's a drive. This is a survival mechanism. I mean, we put, as I said, people in brain scanners, and the brain circuitry for romantic love lies very near the brain circuitry for thirst and hunger. Thirst and hunger aren't going to go away. Romantic love isn't going to go away, even if we live a million years from now. And those girls in college, by the time they're 27, they'll both be married.
But those girls in college are going to age, and I have several friends who focused on their careers, postponed commitment, had multiple boyfriends who were lovely, men who were either had gone to college with them. As they approached 40 and in their late 30s and were getting desperate, not even so much to have a partner, but to have a child, and their options had limited dramatically because the men who were available who were 38 were dating 25-year-olds. They weren't interested in the old model. So you kind of shut yourself out of the market. Three of these girls I know personally settled for guys that they never would have dated in college because that was what was available to them and they really wanted to have kids.
Right.
So what do you do about that phenomenon?
Well, I mean, I'm not advocating slow love. That's what I end up, that's what I see in the data, and that's what I'm reporting. I'm a reporter. So,
is that a healthy evolutionary response to that situation where you just said to yourself, look, this is where I'm at. I want a kid. I found a guy. I'm moving on with this.
They may fall in love down the road. I mean, I'm not in the should business. I'm in the business of data. I do think that it gets more and more dangerous as you get older. But some people settle in their 20s because they want to have the child right then, too. And maybe we all settle in some ways at all kinds of ages. I'll tell you who doesn't settle. I have one questionnaire on Match.com. Two of my favorite questions were, would you make a long-term partnership with somebody who had everything you were looking for, but you were not in love with that person? And another question was, would you make a long-term commitment to somebody who had everything you were looking for, but you did not find that person sexually attractive? The least likely to compromise are women over 60. And you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm over 60. And I've met men, one man I met in Arizona. And he had everything I was looking for. But I wasn't in love with him, and I did not find him sexually appealing. Would I move to Arizona from the middle of Manhattan to go out with somebody I was not in love with and did not find sexually attractive? No. The young will compromise, and the young compromise.
But your life was too built by that time, and you were too happy with it.
And so are most women over 60.
Right.
It's built by then.
Yeah.
But the young need to compromise. They need to get on to having a family. So you'll see the young moving across the country to a place they don't know, building whole new friendships, et cetera. I would suggest, and I don't know any data for or against it, that the young are more likely to settle than older people.
You said that you weren't in love with this gentleman in Arizona.
Yeah.
And you're a neurobiologist and anthropologist, and you study the chemistry of what it means to be in love, like what's going on hormonally in our bodies. Yeah. But Jill and I were talking about this earlier, and you had a question about the spiritual. Jill, my resident atheist, had a question about the spiritual element
so,
of love.
Yes, I am an atheist, but... and I can't even say I'm spiritual but not religious. I just think I wear lead shoes and clomp along on the earth.
You don't wear lead shoes and clomp. I'm exactly like you, and I get tremendous joy out of knowing the universe, of knowing human relations. I mean, I think there's just great joy and power and connection with every living thing without having to believe in a God.
All I can say is I show up in the world very enthusiastically.
Yeah.
I think that's
there
it.
You go.
I think that's end of story. But my question for you was, you know the biology of love in such intimate specifics. Do you feel like, with your understanding of the chemistry and the biology of it, that there is a spiritual component to love, that there is something that transcends? Because, of course, that is what we feel. That's what we feel when our brains are lighting up like that.
You'd have to define spirituality for me to really understand that question. But I do think that, religiosity has a genetic component, and it's in the serotonin system in the brain. And some people can much more easily believe in a God. Other people are less predisposed to doing that. But when you're madly in love, I mean, you can believe anything. I mean, these positive illusions are just...
You think you can fly.
But I guess I would question exactly what you mean by spirituality.
I guess I'm just wondering, put aside the great love songs and the Hollywood movies, I think... when you're deeply in love with someone, you feel like there's something in your bond that is more powerful than either one of you.
I think that's true. Because back to these three brain systems, sex drive, feelings of intense romantic love, and feelings of deep attachment. When you're madly in love with somebody, you are pumping up the dopamine system. And with that comes positive illusions, overlooking the negative, all of a sudden you regard this person as special. Everything about them is special. Their house is special. Street they live in, on is special. Their car is different from every other car in the parking lot. Everything is special. You feel elation when things are going well. Mood swings into horrible despair when things are going poorly. Intense energy. You can walk all night and talk till dawn. Butterflies in the stomach. Dry mouth. Wobbly knees when you're around them. Self-conscious. Possessive of them. Craving to kiss and hug with them, and also obsessive thinking about them, intense motivation to win them, and a real craving for emotional union with them. Sure, you'd like to go to bed with them, but what you really want is to have them say, I love you, you know, be mine. So is that spiritual? You can certainly convert that into a spiritual feeling about somebody if that's the way your
brain
works.
Sounds like a very strong belief system anyway.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But so, we all feel the intense romance. I mean, everywhere in the world, people pine for love, they live for love, they kill for love, and they die for love. It's one of the most powerful brain systems the human animal has ever evolved. And it evolved for an important reason, to enable you to focus your mating energy on just one individual and start the mating process and send your DNA into tomorrow. I mean, you know, thirst and hunger keep you alive today. Romantic love and attachment drive your DNA into tomorrow and make you enable you to survive. So they're powerful things, and if you want people converted into a spiritual experience, so be it.
We've been talking about love and marriage. When we come back, we're going to talk about dating.
Let's talk about breakups, too.
Breakups, too. We were just talking about marriage and love with Dr. Helen Fisher. I want to talk about that early stage that gets us to marriage eventually, possibly, maybe, sometimes not. How have the rules of dating changed with technology and birth control and the Me Too movement? What are we dealing with now that we haven't had to deal with or hadn't dealt with in the past?
Such a big question.
Sorry.
Let's see where to begin. Well, you know, technology cannot change love. Love is a brain system. Romantic love is a brain system. Attachment is a brain system. These are going to be with us as long as we survive as a species. These are brain systems like the fear system or the anger system or the disgust system. It's a real brain system. It's not going to change. But the way we are courting is dramatically changing. You know, in my day, they called you on the telephone. Well, these days they text you, they email you.
They swipe you.
Absolutely. one of the things that, you know, as I say, I work with Match, but one of the, what they find now actually is that, when we ask at Match, where did you meet your last first date? 40% of singles say on the internet. Only 25% say through a friend. And less than 8% say at church or in a bar. So,
well, you can't say at work anymore.
No.
Although
they do, we do ask about that. And there's no question about it that people do meet people. People meet people who are around. And you really get to know people at work. Now, of course, we're seeing a great entrepreneurial rise. So more and more people are working at home. And, you know, telecommuting, et cetera. So that's changing, too. And what we're marrying so much later that by the time you're even in your early 30s and 40s anyway, you know everybody in your social circle. You know everybody at work. And so people are turning to the dating sites to court. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm too old to stand in a bar and wait for the perfect boy to come by. It's not going to happen to Helen Fisher. But there
I've actually heard that people in their 20s find it creepy when somebody approaches them at a party or in a bar.
No kidding.
It is not it doesn't feel like a clean interaction. They would much rather have it facilitated through technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the recent findings comes from out of the University of Chicago is that people who dated and met their partner on the internet are less likely to divorce. And I can only guess why. At first I thought, I don't know, it's only one study. It doesn't. Why would it make any difference whether you met in a bar or on a boat or in the Museum of Natural History? I mean, why would it make any difference? But my hypothesis is that, you really get to know some things about somebody on the internet before you even meet them. So there's probably a lot of pre-selection. He's a golfer. I can't stand golf. I don't want to spend every Saturday with him gone. I'm going to go look for another. But the biggest problem, first of all, there's a couple things that people don't understand about the internet. One of them is that it's a new technology and you have to learn how to use it. And one of the problems is that the human brain gets swamped. It's called cognitive overload. You've probably heard that term. And, after a certain number, you meet a certain number of people, you don't go out with anybody. So one of the things that I say to people who are going to work, meet on the internet is, after you've met 9 people, the sweet spot in the brain is apparently between 5 and 9. And after you've met 9 people, stop. Stop meeting people and get to know one or more better. Psychologists clearly say that the more you get to know somebody, the more you like them, and the more you are going to think that person is for you. So you got to, it's like
it reminds
any
me
new
of
technology.
Trying on perfumes at a department store.
That's a good example.
Like you get nose blindness.
You need
is
the
what
coffee.
It's
nose blindness.
Right.
That's a very good. And the other thing is that what people don't understand is that the only real algorithm is your own brain. At Match, at any one of these other sites, we can give you somebody who's the right background and education and interest, et cetera. But you can walk into a room and everybody's from your background and level of education and same religious and social values. The only real algorithm is right above your neck, your own brain. We can give you people so that you could kiss fewer frogs, but you have to do the work. You got to get out there and look at the people. So the two things that I say is, A, stop after 9 people, and B, think of reasons to say yes. We get so picky. Oh, he has brown shoes. I gotta have somebody with black shoes. That's nonsense. You gotta get to know somebody. Just, think of reasons to say yes instead of no.
When you're going through a dramatic change in your love life, you're falling in love, you're falling out of love, you're breaking up, someone's betrayed you. What's going on in your brain and how can you cope with it?
We have put over 100 people into this brain scanner, as I've mentioned, and a good number of them were people who had been rejected in love. And in fact, the brain really has a fire going on. The dopamine system is going wild because you're still madly in love with the person. Attachment regions are remaining active. You still feel deeply attached to this person. The 3 brain regions become active, linked with craving and obsessive thought. And a brain region becomes active that is linked with physical pain. It's exactly the same brain region that becomes active when you have a toothache. So you are in real trauma when you are breaking up with somebody. And I've long felt that it can turn into a real addiction, an obsession with somebody. So how do you manage that? I would use some of the basic things of addiction. In other words, get rid of the cards and letters. Don't write. Don't call. Don't show up. Get a lot of exercise. Be around old friends. Hug and kiss them. Drives up the oxytocin system.
Because you're missing that oxytocin that you've gotten from your relationship contact?
Yes. Okay. Your daily habits, the daily hugging and kissing and stroking and talking drives up and sustains that oxytocin system. And when that person is no longer there, the oxytocin will probably plummet. Serotonin will probably plummet. You can get into a state of complete panic. And so what you've got to do is soothe yourself. One of the problems is that women talk about it too much. It is good to talk about it. In fact, there's a whole brain region linked with figuring out your gains and your losses. So when you have been rejected in love, the brain is naturally trying to figure out, what have I gained? What have I learned? What have I lost? How do I get that back? Let's find out. Did I lose the dog? Did I lose the house? Did I lose the children? Did I lose the neighbors? Did I lose my job? Did I lose my economic stability? What did I gain? Did I gain some knowledge? Did I gain the dog and the house and the children? And can I now move on from a difficult relationship? So the brain is very well built for coming to grips with this. One of the problems that women have is that they talk, after a while, they talk too much about it. And what they're really doing is just raising the ghost and re-traumatizing themselves. With me, one time with a man, I'd been just really just in the dumps and quite rejected. And my girlfriends were very nice to be saying, well, how are you feeling today? And I finally ended up saying, you know, let's not talk about him. Let's talk about this thing that I read. Just get them out of your head. There's somebody camping in your head. Men express their depression differently. They kill themselves more often, but they also drive too fast, drink too much, hole up and watch TV, persecute themselves in other ways. So we did find that time does heal. We have proven that. The farther you get away from that moment of relationship collapse, the less activity there is in brain regions linked with attachment. But anyway, in your other question about, you know, how do you manage real change, whether it's a breakup or whether it's really just moving to another city or moving to a new house or getting a new job, what you really want to do is drive up the dopamine system in the brain. It's dopamine that gives you that energy, that focus, that motivation, that optimism. And so I'm not a nutritionist, but this is apparently some of the things you could eat and do to sustain the dopamine system, not in a romantic relationship, although I would add that to it, but in any kind of transitional time. Apparently, these are the things that drive up dopamine in the brain. Watermelon, green tea, ripe bananas, not too ripe, apples, spinach, broccoli, and cauliflower, ginseng, all seem to help trigger dopamine in the brain. And in terms of behavioral patterns, exercise drives up the dopamine system, gives you that feeling of energy and relaxation. Meditation apparently is very good for balancing all of the neurotransmitters and hormones and controlling your weight. So that's less sugar, less carbs.
So all of getting healthy actually is a dopamine trigger.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? I only discovered that today.
It is interesting. And we have heard that for a lot of people, dealing with change, a first step is saying, I'm going to try and get healthier. I'm going to try and take care of myself. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Maybe there is that a really human instinct, a preservation instinct that isn't just, hey, I want to control and get a grip on my health and my body, but more, I need to cure this in myself.
Isn't that interesting? And I would add one thing that I do, and it's probably, I had recently heard about, I mean, I've always known about cognitive behavioral therapy, but I didn't realize I was doing it. But what I'll do when I think, oh my God, I can't do this. Helen, you just can't do this. And I say, wait a minute. And I start repeating to myself over and over, I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. I can do this, over and over and over. And it really helps. Whether that sort of psychological boost drives up the dopamine, I don't know.
But you should study that.
I should study it.
Somebody just put yourself in a brain scanner.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really. Oh, I would imagine you would find, you always find something in a brain scanner.
Helen, thank you so much. It's been a very elucidating conversation. I really enjoyed having you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you so much, Helen. And to our listeners, to get more from the wise and wonderful Helen Fisher, just go to theanatomyoflove.com. That's theanatomyoflove.com.
And reach out to us at U-Turns Podcast. We want to hear from you. Tell us your stories of transformation and relationship change.